Hello there. Today is Thursday, September 14th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, hurricane recovery continues in much of the state of Florida and the Caribbean.
My house, my business, both my vehicles, everything is gone.
A Florida nursing home is now under criminal investigation after eight elderly patients are found dead. The 2016 presidential election, Hillary Clinton has a new book on how it felt to lose. Also ahead, the first ever American Idol winner will be doing a television show, but not that one. It's all on today's International Edition. President Trump plans to visit hurricane-ravaged Florida later today, where recovery is slow but steady. He'll stop in Naples on Florida's west coast, which was directly in the path of Hurricane Irma. Officials say restoring power is their top priority. It could be as long as a month for power to be fully restored across the state. Residents of U.S. citizens of the Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico are begging the government not to forget about them.
Our government did nothing. Nothing. People come out with machetes, offering bullets and saying there's more for you, breaking into houses, hurting people.
Back on the mainland, though, officials are now investigating whether lack of electricity to run air conditioning is to blame for the deaths of eight nursing home patients in Hollywood, Florida. The deaths were discovered when a hospital across the street from the nursing home began receiving the elderly patients suffering from heat exhaustion. Governor Rick Scott has called for a criminal investigation. Joining me now to discuss how this could have happened is Jack Halpern. He is the CEO of My Elder Advocate. Thank you for being with us. So this is just astonishing. How did this happen?
To me, it's not that shocking. It is just the lack of many nursing homes. They have an emergency plan, but it's, in some book, in some administrator's office, collecting dust. It is the federal law requires that all healthcare institutions have an emergency plan, and also they have to practice their emergency plan. I believe it's every quarter. I'm almost certain once the investigation is completed that no one at the facility, from the probably the administrator down, had any idea. I even doubt that they had the emergency plan, but if they had it, I don't believe that it was ever practiced. Now, certainly if it wasn't practiced all year, it should have certainly practiced as soon as the nursing home became aware that this storm was coming. I mean, it didn't come from one day to the next.
Why didn't a nursing home that was in the line of fire here with Irma, why didn't they just evacuate when everybody else was being told to get out? They pretty much guaranteed everybody was going to lose power. So a nursing home with temperatures
Absolutely.
90 to 100 degrees inside, it seems to me it just doesn't make sense.
You're absolutely correct, and that would have been part of that emergency plan. What they should have done is certainly evacuate, and many of the hospitals and many other nursing homes that are more inland, at least, or areas that might not have needed to be evacuated, would have accepted those particular residents. So they should have evacuated them well before they were in the eye of the storm. Why they didn't do it? Because there are many nursing homes across the country that are just substandard, very, very understaffed, and the facilities and the department heads in those facilities are just very lax. So when a hurricane comes and a nursing home is in total disarray, there's just no one there to take responsibility, and they believe that, this is not going to happen, or they're going to weather the storm, or just do not know what to do, do not know how to make any preparations, do not know how to arrange to move at least the most vulnerable. I guess everyone's vulnerable in that situation. And we see this happen at every single hurricane. Now, the government also bears responsibility because a nursing home is inspected by the various departments of health, certainly in Florida as well. They are inspected every year, and part of that inspection is to their evacuation plan, their emergency plan. What would they do if they had to evacuate? Where would they send their patients? And they have to have these arrangements well in place before a hurricane, and even if there's no hurricane forthcoming. So if you have a bad facility and that facility is poorly inspected by the government and there is no one there to check out if they've practiced their emergency plan or practiced their evacuation plan, then it's just not going to happen. So why? Because it's a bad facility and it's poorly regulated. So that is the problem. In many nursing homes across the country, every nursing home was specifically instructed to beef up their emergency plan, which includes a viable evacuation plan. But did anybody check to see if they've done it? No.
Do you believe that there could be some criminal action
taken?
Absolutely.
Yes, absolutely.
So they definitely broke some laws, in your opinion?
They broke the law 100%. If the law says that you have to, in a healthcare facility, that you have to have emergency procedures and that you have to practice that and you have to practice an evacuation plan and you don't, then you are breaking the law. And these people should promptly be arrested and charged with murder. Breaking a law doesn't mean just doing something. It also means not doing something that you have absolute responsibility to do. But I'm certain that they were not the only nursing home. They were the only nursing home that had, the kind of tragedy that they had. But there were probably many nursing homes in Florida or in other states, certainly in Texas, that had these same problems. They were just lucky enough to not have deaths. I will bet you that the administrator and his, upper staff were not even near the facility during the time that this happened. There are 100 things that they could have done, but they are criminally liable for what happened in that nursing home.
All right, Jack Halpern, CEO of My Elder Advocate. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. The outgoing U.S. ambassador to Russia saw evidence that Russia hacked the U.S. election. Central Europe is jittery on the eve of massive Russian exercises. Nuclear weapons experts warn Trump against abandoning the Iran deal. And the Trump administration will soon decide the fate of thousands of temporary immigrants. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Well, less than a year after her election loss, former presidential candidate Hillary Clinton published a book in which she explains what she believes led to the outcome her supporters didn't anticipate. Clinton's fans have been lining up at various venues to grab a signed copy of her book titled What Happened? Meanwhile, before he even knew what the outcome would be, a journalist was also working on a book about that contentious campaign. Joining me now to discuss his book, The Great Divide, Story of the 2016 U.S. Presidential Race, is author Howard Harrison. Thank you so much for joining us. So Hillary Clinton's been doing a lot of interviews about her book, and it sounds like she's really let her guard down about what it was like to lose and then to attend President Trump's inauguration.
I can't wait to read hers. Mine is also could have just as easily been titled What Happened, which would have been interesting to see if then she would have titled, what she would have titled hers. But mine was simply Story of the 2016 U.S. Presidential Race. I covered it journalistically, so I covered it in real time. I started covering it in June of 2015 when Donald Trump entered the ring with 16 other Republican candidates, and I began writing chapters every week, couple of weeks, whatever, whenever there seemed to be a strong storyline for the next chapter. And before I knew it, by the end of the election, there's 75 chapters. So I covered it in real time. I covered the events journalistically. But, of course, I sprinkle in my opinions. And I'm a lifelong Democrat, and I was never expecting the result we got.
Right.
Yet throughout the book, I'm telling people, you know, it's going to come down to Republicans versus Democrats at the end. Those GOP voters are not going to care about the character of this guy. They're not going to care about the sexual assault allegations or the lying. They care about their agenda. You know, they care about their issues, and they're not going to vote against that. They're going to vote for that very strongly.
Mm-hmm.
And then he had his own hero worshippers that were, you know, they admired his wealth. They liked the way he talked like their crazy uncle, you know, and so forth. And so I wasn't shocked. But throughout the book, I'm writing the book in real time, really not expecting the result. And when I go back and read it myself now, it's like pretty cool. It foreshadows a lot of the things we're seeing. So,
well,
as far as Hillary's goes, I can't wait to hear, you know, hers is going to be from the inside,
right.
You know, from her perspective inside her campaign. Completely different. Mine's a complete outside journalist perspective.
But you mentioned it's going to come down to Republican or Democrat, and Republicans are going to go with the Republicans so they can get their agenda through. As we're seeing things transpire now, they're not really getting their agenda through. They're caught up in a myriad of, I guess you could say, stumbling blocks, to say the least. And we are hearing people come out and say...
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. I still think if push came to shove, and this is kind of a bold statement, but if the election were held again tomorrow, I think Trump would win again. One of the reasons I don't think they're getting a lot done is because the division within that party is so great. And one of the reasons I think the division within that party is so great is that party does not represent the majority of Americans on very many issues, but they represent a lot of minority opinions that put together, I mean, the majority of Americans agree in a woman's right to terminate an unwanted pregnancy. Yet Republicans have enough people that don't believe that that's a big part of their coalition. Same with people that don't believe in gay marriage. Same with rich, greedy billionaires who want to hang on to every cent they can, plus your white supremacists, plus you. None of these people represent the majority of the American people, but you put them all together, and that party is tough to beat. So they're not getting legislation through because, you know, even on health care, when they went back to their constituents said, hey, we want our health care. Don't take away our health care. Yeah, so they don't really represent the majority opinion, but they put together a great coalition for winning elections. And I really think that's what some of this dysfunction is about.
Since you followed this entire election and you are a writer and a journalist, what do you think of the way that this president and then candidate Trump has portrayed the news media?
I think it is abominable. I went to journalism school. I have a journalism degree. I know we were not taught to hate the Republican Party or students today to hate this president. The people that work in journalism today, the reporters out there, the ones you see on CNN, and then all the ones that you don't see that work for all the papers and the news bureaus, these people work really, really hard. These are really hardworking, conscientious people, and for the president of the country to just with a broad stroke, just label them fake news or dishonest media, these are the people that are ruining our country, is to me, it's beyond irresponsible.
What is it about that upsets you the most?
Because most of what is reported on is true. At least most of the things he labels as fake are true. And again, if you listen to reporters, like people like yourself and a million others,
mm-hmm.
and sit down and have conversations with them and listen to how they talk and report, and if you can judge character, if you can judge honesty, you know, in people that are doing their job, and then you sit and observe the temperament of this president and how he responds to things, you tell me who you would believe. Mm-hmm. I just think it's very irresponsible for the president to say that.
All right. Thank you for being with us and taking the time to talk about your book, The Great Divide, Story of the U.S. Presidential Race 2016, author Howard Howerson. Turning now to our social media segment, we're joined by Andrew Palchevsky. Hey, Andrew, what's going on?
Well, the big story that we've been talking about over the past few days is, of course, that announcement from Facebook that they shut down a number of ads that violated their terms of service. Mm-hmm. These ads specifically were created by Russian-linked groups to try to influence the U.S. presidential election.
Right.
Now, they spent about $100,000 on these 3,000 ads, mm-hmm. not necessarily to advocate for or against a specific candidate, mm-hmm. but to advocate different issue positions okay. on things like guns, immigration, LGBT issues. The idea being that if you influence those positions and put out ads about those different issues, you would influence people in the election.
Hmm.
Well, the Daily Beast reports that it wasn't just ads that these groups were behind. They were also behind some events. And they cite a specific event in August 2016. It was an anti-immigrant, anti-Muslim rally in the U.S. state of Idaho. And a Facebook representative tells the Daily Beast that they shut down several promoted events, including this one, as part of the takedown. Now, it's not clear how many of these events there were or what the scope was. The one that the Daily Beast cites was hosted by a group called Secured Borders, and it was an anti-immigrant community. That group had over 100,000 followers when Facebook shut it down.
Man.
And this event that they talk about had several dozen people said that they were interested in attending. It's interesting to see why this is growing. We talked about this yesterday, that this was only scratching the surface as to how much influence there was. Once we dug down into what these 3,000 ads were, the different groups were, we were going to see a lot more of this come to light. And indeed, that's exactly what we're seeing now. We're seeing that it wasn't just groups or ads that were being sponsored and created. It was also events and trying to get people to mobilize in real life. Now, this has caught the attention of the Senate Intelligence Committee.
Hmm.
They have talked before about policing information on social media, particularly with terror groups. Now they're trying to do it with Russia. And in fact, they want Facebook and Twitter to testify in front of the Senate Intelligence Committee about these efforts and what they're doing to combat them and to shed even more light on them. We'll see if that testimony happens in the near future. But this issue, as we said yesterday, is not going away anytime soon.
All right. Thanks, Andrew. You can follow him on Twitter at APAL. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Well, Myanmar's de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi has canceled plans to attend this month's UN General Assembly amid rising international criticism of her handling of the violence in western Myanmar that's forced as many as 370,000 ethnic Rohingya Muslims to flee across the border to Bangladesh. UN Human Rights Chief Zaid Rahad Al Hussein spoke at an emergency meeting on the violence and subsequent humanitarian crisis.
Because Myanmar has refused access to human rights investigators, the current situation cannot yet be fully assessed. But the situation remains, or seems, a textbook example of ethnic cleansing.
The UN Children's Fund says Rohingya camps are crowded with children who are in a fragile state. As many as 200,000 children may be at risk of waterborne diseases and in urgent need of support. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong.
You love music?
How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
I'm Victor Beatty. Since 1942, the Voice of America has been a consistently reliable and authoritative source of news. Today, VOA remains committed to providing an accurate, objective, and comprehensive news product at the top of every hour, every day. We can be heard on your local affiliate or streamed on the web at voanews.com.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, in New York City, it's all about supermodels, fashion shows, parties, street style as Fashion Week gets underway. Somali-American model Iman was one of the most sought-after fashion models in the 70s and 80s, and now another Somali-American model is making headlines as the first hijab-wearing woman to walk the runway in New York and Italy. Faith Lapidus introduces us to Halima Aden.
Among the young women in last year's Miss Minnesota USA pageant was Halima Aden.
who competed in a hijab and a burkini.
I wear the hijab every day, you know, so it's like if I'm going to try something new, I'm going to take that part with me. And it was just a no-brainer.
The Somali-American teen was not crowned Miss Minnesota, but she did win a contract with a major modeling agency. The first hijab-wearing model to sign with a top agency. The world of high fashion is a far cry from the Kakuma refugee camp in Kenya, where Aiden was born. Before her family left for the United States, she had a diverse group of playmates.
Different people, different refugees from all over Africa came together in Kakuma, yet we still found common ground. The kids, like, we played, all of us, and, you know, we celebrated each other's holidays, if that makes sense. There's not that many opportunities in Kakuma, so when it was Christmas, best believe we're all going to celebrate. And when it's Eid, we all celebrated that too.
She says that's not always the case in the United States. But the hijab is becoming a more familiar sight in American fashion. Nike will launch a breathable mesh hijab next year, and American Eagle Outfitters created a denim hijab with Aiden as its main model. Aiden was featured on the June cover of Vogue magazine, and in July, she graced the cover of the beauty magazine Allure.
She truly is just like a normal teenage girl, a normal American teenage girl. So I think that for us, again, like our mission being we want to redefine what beauty standards are. I think she's someone who's so amazingly representative of who we are as America, as a melting pot. It just totally made sense for us.
As Aiden enjoys her current success, she remains grateful for the UN efforts in Kakuma. She hopes to return to the camp one day to work with refugee children, to show them they also have the potential to become international stars. I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News, Washington.
Well, singer Kelly Clarkson will be joining a television show, but not the one that made her famous. VOA's Border Crossings host Larry London joins International Edition's Sarah Williams with details.
She was the very first American Idol back in 2001 when the show made its debut on Fox. The show is coming back now in 2018 on ABC TV. They've got Katy Perry signed to be a judge. They've got Ryan Seacrest signed to be back as the host. But they didn't sign Kelly Clarkson to return as a judge to American Idol, the show that made her famous. Instead, she opted to become a judge on The Voice. So she's going to be competing with her old show.
But, how interesting.
Yeah, well, that's the way things work. Now, Kelly Clarkson herself has been in this game for a long, long time. In fact, around 8 is when she started to sing and get the bug for singing. Her mom put her in the church choir. So she grew up in Texas singing gospel music. And since that time, she has obviously become very, very famous. And she's about to release what will be her 8th album. And she signed a new contract with a new record label. So she said, finally, I get to release an album more in sync with the kind of music I like. So this new album on Atlantic is called Meaning of Life. It's coming out in October, and she says it's going to have R&B flavors, which is kind of what she really likes to do. She's had many, many hits, obviously. We know over the years she's won so many awards, 3 Grammys, 3 MTV Video Awards, 4 American Music Awards, 2 Academy of Country Music Awards. So she's another artist who's done country and pop and done them both very successfully. So we're going to check out a brand new song right now on International Edition from Kelly Clarkson. This is called Love So Soft.
Every kiss is a door. Can I knock on yours? Can we knock a little more? If the touch is a key, keep on twisting, keep on locking, keep on turning me.
All right, it's interesting when you think she started her career on American Idol. How many pop stars have made it big?
You know what, American Idol, I would have to say, first of all, it's one of the longer running reality shows that discover musical talent. And it just also happens to be a show that has produced successful talent. You think of people like Jordan Sparks, you think of Carrie Underwood, you think of Daughtry, and the list goes on and on and on for the people who have taken their exposure on American Idol and turned it into a successful career. None as big as Kelly Clarkson. There seems to be an ongoing competition between Kelly and Carrie Underwood as to who can sell more records. Right now, Kelly's sales are in excess of 25 million albums, 36 million singles. So Kelly has the edge right now on Carrie, although Carrie is very, very close behind. Now, in addition to being a great pop star, country star, she's also a wonderful mom. She's got 2 kids of her own at home. She married Brandon Blackenstock. He had 2 from a previous marriage. So she said she's trying to balance being a mom to four kids with a career, which is quite demanding. But she's managed to put it all together. In addition to that, she's also found time to write two children's books. The first one, which came out a year ago, was called River Rose and the Magical Lullaby. And by the way, her daughter's name is River Rose.
Aww.
And the new one is called River Rose and the Magical Christmas. And that comes out as well in October. And you can expect a new song, probably a holiday song, I'm guessing, along with the new book that's coming out. So she's got a lot going on. Meaning of Life is the new album name. And it's going to be exciting when we get to hear the album.
Absolutely. River Rose is such a pretty name.
It is beautiful. And Kelly Clarkson makes beautiful music. And today's new song from Kelly is called Love So Soft.
All right. Thanks a lot, Larry. That's Larry London. He's the host of VOA's Border Crossings.
I'm James Butte, host of Daybreak Africa. Join me every weekday mornings at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of the show through our listeners' mail segment. Just send your views to daybreakafrica@voanews.com or call us on 202-205-9942. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. Department of the Treasury announced targeted sanctions on two South Sudanese government officials and one former official for their roles in threatening the peace, security, or stability of South Sudan. Three companies that are owned or controlled by one of the officials were also sanctioned. The measures taken against Malik Ruben Riak Rengu, Michael Makui Lewith, and Paul Malong Awan make clear that the U.S. government will impose consequences on those who expand the conflict and derail peace efforts. The Treasury Department also released a Financial Crimes Enforcement Network advisory alerting U.S. financial institutions to the possibility that certain South Sudanese senior political figures may try to use the U.S. financial system to move or hide proceeds of public corruption. The United States stands ready to impose other measures against those responsible for undermining the peace, security, or stability of South Sudan. As the advisory demonstrates, the United States is committed to increasing scrutiny on those who enrich themselves through corruption, while the South Sudanese people suffer through economic hardship and a dire humanitarian crisis. 6 million people in South Sudan, half of the population, face life-threatening hunger, while more than 4 million people have been displaced from their homes, including 2 million refugees. This is a man-made crisis and one the government of South Sudan can stop, said State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert. We continue to make clear to South Sudan's leaders that they must honor their declared ceasefire, revive the 2015 agreement on the resolution of the conflict in the Republic of South Sudan by engaging meaningfully with opposition parties, bring an end to atrocities, stop the harassment of aid workers, stem human rights abuses, cooperate fully with the United Nations mission in South Sudan, and take action against corruption, said Ms. Nauert. The United States urges all parties to engage constructively in the upcoming South Sudan peace process.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.